Charlie Starr's insightful and readable explanation of why myth matters is the most illuminating, interesting, and important book on myth and mythopoeia that I am aware of. Peter Skackle, author of The Way into Narnia, and Imagination and the Arts in C.S. Lewis.
Welcome to All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, author of The Misquotable C.S. Lewis, and also the author of a study guide to the Screwtape Letters called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. On the show today, I have Dr. Charlie Starr talking about his new book, The Fawn's Bookshelf, C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters. This interview was recorded the night before the start of the 2018 Taylor Colloquium at Taylor University, where he gave one of the keynote talks. In the spirit of full disclosure, I did receive an advance copy of the book and endorsed it. However, the endorsement and this interview was done because of how much I enjoyed the book. Welcome back to All About Jack, Charlie.
Thanks, William. I am so glad to be here.
Let's start off by having you describe or summarize your book, which is, again, The Fawn's Bookshelf, subtitle C.S. Lewis on Why Myth Matters.
Well, sure. The book began with a speech that I gave a few years ago at a conference in which I talked about the four books that Lucy sees in Mr. Tumnus's library in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. One of these was The Life and Letters of Silenus. Nymphs and Their Ways was another. The third, Men, Monks, and Gamekeepers, A Study in Popular Legend, and Is Man a Myth? And I expanded that then into a book form in which I spent a lot of time on those four books in Tumnus's library, looking first at Lewis's love for the invention of fake books and authors, then at the sylvan myths of fauns, nymphs, and Bacchus and their significance as warnings against industrialization and progress, and then at the dehumanizing of mankind in a materialist universe, one which both reduces humanity to mere mythology while failing to realize that our real problem is that we're not mythic enough. Other chapters in The Fawn's Bookshelf define myth, consider the best order for reading the Narnia books for the most mythic impact on the reader, consider the relationship between myth, gender, and incarnation, examine myth and mythopoeia, explore the possibility that myth is much closer to fact than we think, and look at Lewis's love for Norse myth. The final chapter also takes up a puzzle in Lewis's writing on myth, a possible contradiction of thought which Lewis scholars have known about for a while, but for which no satisfactory answer has yet been offered. I'm not 100% sure that my answer is satisfactory either, but I gave it a shot. So folks can take a look and see what they think.
Well, now, since your book is about myth, let's go ahead and cover the elementary basis for those who maybe aren't as familiar, and a good reminder for those who are. That is, you know, what is myth, especially contrast Lewis's view and how it is similar or different from the average person's perspective on myth.
So modern thought, especially on myth, is simply that it's stories that aren't true. If they aren't true, they are irrelevant in terms of any kind of knowledge value. They are mere mythology in the worst sense of the word, and that's how we tend to use the word mythology. These are ancient stories, ancient beliefs that people no longer believe in today. But that really is a terrible definition of myth, and Lewis would have rejected it out of hand. It's especially obvious by the fact that we continue to invent myth today. All right, if we're going to deny God or the existence of the gods, we'll simply invent our own gods and call them superheroes. And there'll be people like a guy named Kal-El, whose last name is the name of God in the Hebrew Bible, who comes from a far-off place sent by a father who brings salvation to mankind and so on, right? The original Superman died on a cross and did a much better job of saving mankind than Clark Kent, as much as I love what we're doing with modern myth. So we continue to invent myth. We just don't realize that that's what we're doing. For C.S. Lewis, myth is definitely something that has a fancy term, epistemological value, which is to say value in terms of being able to teach us something about reality, value in terms of knowing and truth. If I were to do something like a short definition of myth, and I was trying to think of something this morning on my drive here to Taylor University, I might say that in Lewis's thinking, myth is an image, a story image of a higher reality. that in myth we are given an imaginative tale, and that tale is going to reveal to us something of Platonic essences, a higher reality, heavenly reality, a reality that transcends the mere instances of life events, life experiences that we have here on Earth. And we'll let the listeners decide if they can figure out what I mean by that. I'm not 100% sure that I know what I meant by that.
Well, now let's look at the way you organized your book. It's divided into four parts. Briefly explain, you know, how you came up with that, or why you ended up with that, and then just summarize briefly each of the four parts, and then we'll follow up with looking at each of those.
Yeah, part one is essentially introductory material in which I take up the mere fact that Lewis invented books that he never wrote. Since the four books on Mr. Tumnus's bookshelf are the basis for my entire book, I start just with the fact that here are four non-existent books. That is, Lewis invented the titles for them, but then he never wrote these books. This is something Lewis loved to do all the time, and that leads me then into a nice discussion on Lewis's theory of mythopoeia, which he shared with J.R.R. Tolkien. On the importance of creating not just a story, but an entire world that story inhabits. And that includes then the making of books that might not exist, apart from the fact that you just know a little bit of the title and that sort of thing. So part one deals with that, and then I have another chapter there on fauns. Since these books are on a fauns bookshelf, a faun may be really important to understand. We need to know what fauns are, why they have the books they have, what makes fauns interested in the topics that they're interested in. Why do fauns like nymphs so much? I don't know. Well, we talk about that. We explore that here. And then I also talk about the basic structure of Mr. Tumnus's bookshelf. Now, I'm sure there's a whole lot more books on Tumnus's shelf, but of the four titles we get a sense that, for Lewis, myth has a connection to the real. And so the third chapter of my book is, Might Myth Be Real? And I introduce an idea then that gets carried throughout the rest of the book, which is that there is a connection between myth and reality for Lewis.
Lewis's idea is that God spoke to pagan peoples even through their pagan religions, through their myths and poets. Their gods may have been false, but pictures were still being sent to them by God, not as words of truth spoken propositionally through prophets, but as stories, symbols, and plot elements spoken imaginatively through poets and storytellers. In an early copy of The Pilgrim's Regress that Lewis himself annotated by hand, he wrote the following comment next to history's words about pictures: "There is, in my opinion, a divine element in most mythologies. As Lewis explains in Mere Christianity, God sent to us what I call good dreams. I mean, those queer stories scattered all through the heathen religions about a God who dies and comes to life again, and by his death has somehow given new life to men. One of the myth's connections to reality, then, is epistemological. That is, myth is capable of showing us something of the nature of reality. It can show us truth."
Part two and part three then take up this connection between myth and reality. The first two books in Tumnus's library are books that suggest that what is reality in Narnia is myth here on Earth. So part two is called Narnian Reality, Terran Myth. Part three then is Terran Reality as Myth in Narnia, and deals with the second two books in the series on Tumnus's library, books in which what is reality for us in Narnia is a myth. And so the middle chapters of my entire book then focus very much on the four books in Tumnus's library. And so we look at fauns and nymphs and their connection as a way of dealing with gender issues. In the chapter, fauns are from Mars, nymphs are from Venus. We talk about the Sylvan myths in general and why they mattered so much to Lewis. We start approaching a definition of myth in Chapter 7, and then we take up the last couple of books in Tumnus's library to consider the connections between mankind and myth. And that gets us to part four, Beyond the Bookshelf, which literally is that in the sense that even when we were done, when I was done talking about the books on Mr. Tumnus's bookshelf, there were still some things I felt like we needed to cover for a complete book about myth. And one of the unusual things in Lewis studies, it seems to me, is the fact that as important as myth is to C.S. Lewis, no one has really bothered to write an entire book on Lewis's theory of myth till now. Apologies for bragging, but it just seemed like it needed to be done, and so I did it. And while I certainly could add even more chapters to the book, I did want to take up a couple of more issues. I wanted to definitely talk about mythic knowing and how it represents a kind of knowledge that is ancient to us and may also then foreshadow a kind of knowing that we are not capable of now but will be capable of in the heavenly future. I wanted to spend some time on Lewis and the North. Talking about Tumnus's library had me focusing on Greek myths, Greek and Roman myths, Mediterranean myth. But Lewis, before he loved the Greek myths so much, he loved the Norse myths. And those were the things that took him away. He talks about that great moment when he read Tegner's Drapa in the Longfellow edition. I heard a voice that cried, Balder the Beautiful is dead, and he was swept up into northernness. And he was just passionate and loved Norse myth after that. So we spend some time talking about that. And then at the end, I take up an interpretive mystery in a possible contradiction in Lewis's thinking, a problem that people have known about for a while, but we haven't really tried to solve sufficiently. And I take probably, or what I hope is only the first shot at trying to solve that particular problem.
That's very interesting, Charlie. Thank you for that summary. Now let's go ahead and dig a little bit deeper. We don't want you to give away the farm here. Let's go ahead and first tackle and go into some more detail in terms of part one, which that section is called Folios and Fauns. Is that correct?
That's right. And that's because I spend in part one time talking about fauns and their fantasies and then also the making of many fake books. Again, where Lewis talks about the joy of just completely making up books that don't exist. One of the fun anecdotes with that is he would also make up fake authors, including a fake author's name for himself. He used pseudonyms early in his publishing career, but one of my favorites is the one he uses in which he calls himself either N.W. or N.W. Clerk, and it's a little private joke that he's sharing there with those who know Old English. And, of course, there are so many of those people out there, you know, just constantly, oh, yeah, he's making a joke right there, isn't he? Nat Wilk. Is what the N.W. stands for, and it basically in Old English means not known. And N.W. Clerk, a name he used when he first published his sort of autobiographical look at his own suffering when his wife died, a grief observed. He used that pseudonym. Basically, when you put Nat Wilk and Clerk together, you get the phrase an unknown author. So even in a serious moment there, he likes to play a little joke, and he does that then in a variety of ways. And some of the titles of the books that he invents are hilarious, and we'll leave that to the reader to get take a look at later. But it's important to take a look at what fauns are in Lewis's thinking because of how that whole Sylvan structure plays into key ideas in Lewis's thought. And then again in part three, part one, I take up the question of the connections between reality and myth. One of the most interesting things that Lewis said about myth is that in a myth, you do not get truth, you get tastes of reality. Truth is always about something. Reality is the thing that truth is about. And in myth, you don't get truth, you get tastes of reality. A really remarkable statement, and just a beginning for understanding the nature of myth.
And again, we're talking with Dr. Charlie Starr. The book is entitled The Fauns Bookshelf. Earlier, you were doing the overview about each of your sections, and then you were just talking about the first part. You were combining the second and third part in terms of it having some relation. Go ahead and go into a little bit more detail about the second and third part, but go ahead and remind us what those parts are.
Yeah, the second and third part deal with the four books in Tumnus's library. The first part two deals with the life and letters of Silenus and nymphs and their ways. In life and letters of Silenus, we take up again the question of sylvan myths and what they symbolize. Silenus was the sidekick of Bacchus. A lot of folks have not heard of Silenus, but if you've ever seen the old Disney cartoon Fantasia, you have seen Silenus. He's a little fat guy in a Roman toga riding on a donkey who looks drunk. That's because he is. And he is the guy who goes around with Bacchus. Bacchus is, for lack of a better term, the party god in Roman mythology. Dionysus is his Greek name. And he is significant as a nature god, as a god of incarnation and revelry, and even as an image of Christ. Something, again, that Lewis said that was absolutely wonderful. And I'm thinking he said it in Miracles, though now I'm wondering if he said it in Mere Christianity. And that is that in Christ, when he turns water into wine, we see the god Bacchus. The veil is lifted, and what the god Bacchus represented is actually fulfilled in Christ, who Lewis calls the myth become fact. In Christ, myth is fulfilled, and that's a significant idea there. And Silenus then was his sidekick, and we can see why he might have written letters. Bacchus was too busy partying to write any letters, so Silenus might have taken care of recording Bacchus's exploits and things like that. Now, in Nymphs and Their Ways, then, I took a bit of a risk in moving away from myth to talk about gender issues in Lewis, a hot topic, and some really good writing's been done on that, especially a book entitled Women and C.S. Lewis, which has a number of top-notch authors, especially Dr. Crystal Hurd, who really introduces some great ideas to us about Lewis's family. But the thing that was interesting to me is that the opposite of nymph is not a memph. The opposite of a nymph, that is, the male counterpart to a nymph, is a faun. And the female counterpart to a faun is not a faunette. You get these fauns, and you get these nymphs, and they are the male and female counterpart to each other. And I thought, well, that's certainly a mythic image, a metaphor, for discussing some of the things that Lewis believed about gender. Some of his thoughts are controversial, to say the least. But what I conclude in the end is that Lewis saw in gender spiritual qualities that transcend mere maleness and femaleness, and yet at the same time he believed that those spiritual qualities are tied to the body incarnationally. So he sees masculinity and femininity as transcendent, as spiritual qualities beyond the mere physical body, and yet he sees them very much incarnated in the body, in men and women. And that's where I think maybe a way of clarifying his belief system overall in regard to gender. So I hope I revealed some new insights there in talking about that. The third book in Tumnus's library, Men, Monks, and Gamekeepers, A Study in Popular Legend, is really what started it all with me, because I didn't understand why Lewis would pick those words as legendary in Narnia. Why not men, airplanes, and gamekeepers? Why did he pick men, monks, and gamekeepers as mythic characters in the Narnian world? Well, with men, it's understandable. The Narnians don't know if men exist. Gamekeepers is also understandable. In a land where the animals talk, they don't need gamekeepers. In fact, they'd be unhappy if any showed up, I'm sure. But then why pick the word monks? That was interesting to me, and I guess what occurred to me is the idea that in Narnia, there is no organized religion. There's only Aslan. In Narnia, there are no priests. The people are a priesthood in and of themselves. The animals are a priesthood in and of themselves. So that was an interesting idea to me, and that's what I discussed there. And then in the chapter, Is Man a Myth?, dealing with the last book on Tumnus's bookshelf, I just take up this question: is man a myth? And it's and a dual answer there. The first answer is to say mankind is not a myth in the sense that modernity has turned man into simply a sophisticated animal, that we are just a higher version or a more advanced evolutionary version of all the other animals. We have no special place in the universe. We don't really have thoughts. We only have behaviors, and we have the illusion of thought that goes on in our thinking. And this sort of casts all previous ideas about what it means to be a human being out the window. And that's what modern scientism, to use Lewis's term, did to people. At the same time, then, I sort of flip the script and point out that for Lewis, our problem is that we're not mythic enough. We were meant to be, in a little g sense, gods, something Jesus said in John chapter 10. God intended us for a glory, for a power, for a strength that we're not capable of. Lewis echoes this idea in Perelandra when Ransom sees the Adam and Eve of Perelandra in all their glory, and he bows before them and says, I have never seen a real man or a real woman before in my life, and now I finally have. We were meant to be mythic beings, and because of the fall, we're not anymore. We're meant to be myth, and we're not, and that's our problem. So that's what I take up in the last part of part three.
Well, then, logically, let's have you do another whirlwind summary, this time of the fourth and final part, as it's more of a takeaway, as you were describing earlier, beyond the bookshelf. What would you like the reader to know in summary?
Well, in chapter 10, I think I take up the most difficult concept, and that is, what is mythic knowing, and how is it different from regular knowing, or how about knowing by reason even? And it's very complex to go into in brief, but I'll simply say that for Lewis, mythic knowing represents an ancient kind of thinking in which thoughts are much more like objects and have much more physical effect in the universe. To borrow a term from Owen Barfield that Lewis believed in, it is this idea that concrete thought is a real possibility. Lewis explains a certain difficulty in our ability to know things. He says you can either experience something or you can think about it, but you can't do both at the same time. You can laugh at a joke or you can think about why it's funny. But as soon as you start thinking about why it's funny, it's not funny anymore. And so the one is incredibly abstract. The other is very concrete. And in myth, it's possible to bring those two worlds together. It's possible to experience thought. And that's what I take up in that chapter. Another element I take up in that chapter is the idea that myth is a language apart from words. And I'll just leave that at that, just to give the reader something to think about. The possibility that there is language without language. And for Lewis, that can be found in myth. And I think Barfield and Tolkien would agree with that as well. Chapter 11 then takes up this issue of Lewis and the North and his love of Norse myth. In a recent release of a collection of Lewis's poetry by Don King, some of Lewis's earliest writings, which are narrative poems, which he didn't complete, but they're very nice narrative poems, are on Norse myth and wonderfully written, and they show just how much Lewis loved Norse myth. And then, so I talk about just that influence. And boy, historically, that is so significant because it was Lewis's love of Norse myth that got him connected to J.R.R. Tolkien. And it's probably not an exaggeration to say that without Tolkien, Lewis may have never become a Christian. And it's not at all an exaggeration to say that without Lewis, Tolkien never would have finished writing The Lord of the Rings. So just that little bit of connection there is really, really significant.
Well, I hope that this summary has helped people who haven't yet gotten a copy of your book to definitely go and get one. And let's turn the corner a little bit and have you share about other books that you've written to let the listener know what some possibilities are besides this book here, The Fawn's Bookshelf.
Thanks. The first book I wrote on Lewis is a book called Light, C.S. Lewis's first and final short story. It releases a never-before-released Lewis manuscript, The Light Short Story, the most unusual short story Lewis ever wrote, I think, and certainly the most mysterious. So I talk about the story. The story is actually released in the book. Like I said, Walter Hooper wrote the foreword for that book. I talk about the meaning of light in Lewis's thinking. And I talk about the mystery behind the Light manuscript, which just appeared out of nowhere in 1984. I have some other books as well, a couple of Bible studies. One of my favorites there is a book called Honest to God, which is about wrestling with God and deals with a simple question. What do you do as a Christian when you have a problem and your problem is God? Who do you go to? Who do you talk to? Is there something wrong with you? Are you defective? Are you a Christian mutant when you have a hard time being able to rejoice in your suffering, as James and Peter tell you to do? And the answer is no, and the Bible shows it. So I deal with that topic in that book. I'm also proud to say I've written a little bit of fiction. I have a nice children's book, King Lesserlight's Crown, and a couple of science fiction books with a third on the way in the series on the Tales of Solomon's Star. Interesting action and some interesting reflection as well. Fans who like C.S. Lewis's space trilogy, I think, would like my science fiction books as well.
Oh, very good. Let's go ahead and wrap up, Charlie. I've enjoyed talking with you about the Fawn's bookshelf. And go ahead and do a takeaway summary, 60-second or so, to help encourage those who may be sitting on the fence thinking, well, it sounds like an interesting book, but I don't know. What would you say to encourage them to check it out or to consider, to give it more of a consideration?
I might say this. Myth is more important than we think, and the proof of that is the phenomenon of the most important storytelling of the 20th century. Now, the 20th century was a time of high realism, modernism, where stories had to be realistic and usually miserable, and the fantastic or fantasy were simply relegated to the sidebar. And in the midst of that century, the most popular book written was a myth. It was The Lord of the Rings. And also in the midst of that century, the most important film series in terms of its influence and in terms of its sales was the Star Wars series. For good or ill, it's had a huge influence on film ever since. Now, both Tolkien and George Lucas were attempting deliberately to write myths for modern man. And the fact that they did so successfully shows how much we need myth and how much we want myth. But people don't know why. Well, if you'd like to know why, this is the book you want to pick up and find out.
Well, Charlie, as always, it's been a pleasure to have you on All About Jack.
Thanks, William. I really enjoyed being here.
You've been listening to All About Jack, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty. Be sure to check the show notes for any links mentioned today. You can get those notes either at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show, but it might be just as easy to locate the notes where the audio files are hosted at allaboutjack.podbean.com. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. At either location, you can find various podcast shows with interviews to authors of books about Lewis, an occasional series about a specific Lewis essay, or a special series on Why Read Lewis, and many other podcasts. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. If you don't know how to do that, then check the show notes for a direct link to that, and consider rating my show there on iTunes. Before ending, let me remind you about two books I've published. The most recent is The Misquotable C.S. Lewis. It explores 75 questionable quotations and why you shouldn't share Lewis quotes unless you know he really wrote it. I also reveal the closest things Lewis said related to the questionable sayings I examine. I've also written an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters that's called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. You can learn more about that book by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get an immediate download of a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Purchasing either of my books is a great way to indirectly support this podcast and make sure it remains freely available. Again, thank you for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.